Well, it's been really good to be amongst friends tonight as well. It feels like talking to a bunch of friends in my house, so it's nice to be in my home church sharing with you. When I was preparing this, I think some of you know a little of who I am and some of you know quite a lot of who I am, but in terms of the introduction Ryan interviewed me with earlier with Molly, that you've got a little bit taster more of who I am and why I'm here tonight. And when Henry asked me to preach this, I said, is there a theme? Is it on anything I want? And he said, no, it's your own choice. I thought, oh, good, I'm not going to do it on FGM. And I thought that would be a great relief for you as well, because I thought if it's in the bulletin, nobody will come anyway. But actually, this was the verse I got from God to share with you. And I thought, no, I can't do that. That's about blood. That's nearly as bad as FGM. And then I forgot about it a bit. It kept coming back. So I think whatever we like, this is what you've got from me tonight. As some of you know, I'm a mission partner with St. Barnabas. So I've had a long and rich journey with Mission Task Force in preparing for the last 7 years. And I sit under the umbrella and accountability of the Church Mission Society. And I'm also seconded to an anti-domestic abuse charity called Restored. And it's my heart to help eradicate the harmful practice of female genital mutilation, both across Africa, and as some of you will have seen recently in the press, it's very live and kicking in Britain. Probably about 3,000 girls a year are affected with this in Britain illegally here. So it's not just something we can ignore. And I do feel as Christians, it is our duty to get involved in things, even if they're distasteful. In terms of how I got involved in this, I was working in West Darfur in Africa about 7 years ago, 2005, and met a little girl who happened to have been cut at 5 years old and then raped at 10 years old. And from that rape, she fell pregnant and had her baby. Now, she was only about the same size I am. I know I'm a bit undersized, but she was my height. And she had that pregnancy, kept that baby. And I thought, who is going to speak out for her? She was orphaned, and because the village behind her was burned, and her parents were killed, and her siblings were killed, the whole of her village was killed. And I thought, well, it felt like a little shard of glass went into my heart, and I thought, I really need to do something about this. But I actually thought I probably could just join somebody else and follow what they're doing, but actually there seemed there was nobody else doing this, so I decided that I would follow God's calling and set up a charity. So that's what you heard a little bit about earlier today. So what today is really all about, rather than just talk about FGM, I think it's really about dealing with cultural taboos, and I've classed it under three things: death, discharge, and discrimination, because they're really the things in the Bible that were culturally unacceptable in biblical times, just like FGM is culturally unacceptable in our modern times. And we heard from John earlier in that reading that sets the scene, really. And I think it was the juxtaposition of those two stories of the woman and Jairus that interested me when I looked it up. So what's this reading all about? Well, actually, when was this going on? It was about the first century AD in the late 20s, and it was happening in the edge of the Sea of Galilee. The people group would have been Jewish, and this woman's family was actually unknown. But we know that she was a woman. That would have been a woman who was at least a wife and not an elderly woman. And I think it also brings in parallel with that the setting that I've worked in and the different places I've worked in. So this is Kenya, where I was working. I've worked in about 18 different countries across Africa now. And actually, these biblical parallels are very much alive today as well. Issues of poverty, issues of desperation, countries racked with war. We were only hearing this morning in church about Syria and what's going on there now. And I think what's important about FGM is to think that actually it's a different worldview. The people have a different culture and a different faith. So what are we called to do? Well, something was clearly needed in that time with that woman. And actually, she had a lot of courage. she had a courage to stand against the culture and challenge the status quo. She was a woman who sought to live differently, to know against what she knew. She was willing to risk much to change her own condition and the attitudes of society around her. And sometimes the radical is actually the most healthy in society, not the ones that just follow the crowd, because she sought justice, love, and respect. She sought a cure and fairness for her rights, and I think that's very similar to FGM today. It's an injustice issue, and that's why I think we as Christians are called to stand against it. She also had to stand up to male issues of power, status, and hierarchy. Women were not equal. They're still not equal today, but they have more equalities than they did then. But actually, she was a woman, and just by nature of being a woman, she was impure at least monthly with her periods. And she would have been ostracized as well, because this particular woman bled all the time. She also could show the rules of the culture were unhelpful, the issues of death and blood, and she stood up to her fear of being stoned or excluded from her community. Certainly where I worked in northern Nigeria a year or so ago, that actually as a woman I wasn't allowed out of my house, outside my front door, and if a man came to visit me, even on a harmless errand, I would have been deemed to have been raped by him or deemed to have had sex with him, and actually would have been stoned because I would have tempted him. So I just couldn't have any contact with men at all. And that's what it's like to live under Sharia law, which is certainly something that's coming to Britain. I know Baroness Cox was standing against that recently, because it will change our society if that goes through. So let's look a little bit about what money can buy. And actually, around the world, money can buy very different things. And a number of injustice matters have been living on £5 for our food for the last week, and it certainly does focus the mind. But actually, in these cultures, a woman of 10 to 14 often becomes a fourth wife. She is just bought, and she's really a household servant. In these countries, that automatically means the end of her education. And interestingly enough, it came home to me recently, because my child, if you like, my sponsored child through Compassion, I got a letter for recently saying on Good Friday she'd been dismissed from school. And just like any attentive parents, I was horrified that my child had been dismissed. But actually, when I learned a bit more from the charity, she's been married, and marriage means the end of her education. And that was quite shocking. And I said, well, did she choose to end her education? I think Compassion got more than a mouthful there that day when I called up to find exactly what was going on with my child. So there we are, calmed down and thought, well, there we are. Interestingly enough as well, many of the women who are cut and sewn up with FGM have obstructed labour, because simply their bodies aren't ready to give birth. There are 3 to 4 million women in Africa who are shunned by their community with fistula, which is the complication. This is really incontinence, which is a complication that comes from either early marriage or FGM or both. They are victims of disordered reproductive physiology, and basically their body is just it just gets ruined, really. The shame goes deep, because often what happens is their husbands disown them and divorce them, and their families exclude them from the community. It's a bit like modern day leprosy. This woman needed healing greater than her uncleanness of bleeding. And interestingly enough, I worked with a woman a year or two ago from Uganda, who I was sitting opposite her at work at a charity I was working with, and she heard me doing an interview about fistula surgery. And she said, oh, my sisters had that. And I said, well, what happened to cure her? And they said, oh, no, she wasn't cured. She said she went up the church aisle one day and she defecated because she was doubly incontinent. And her husband and her were thrown out of the church, and she never goes out of her house now. And I said, well, that's crazy. She can have free surgery. And she said, no, she can't. Well, I think she can. So I phoned around a few surgeon friends of mine around the world, and needless to say, she did get free surgery. And I met this sister a year or two later and said, what happened to your sister? And she said she was completely cured. And she said, what's funny, in my family, I say to them, my sister's cured because I met a white woman that stood up for her rights. Now, why that didn't happen in Uganda, who knows what. Like that woman with fistula surgery, this woman tried to hide in the crowd, but she was less able to because she smelt. And certainly when I worked in Nigeria at 50 degrees, if someone's incontinent, they certainly smell. In the United States, 30% of births have a cesarean section. In Africa, it's 1.3%. And yet in Africa, 20% of the world's births has 20% of the world's births, but 40% of maternal death. So this is why we need to stand against these things. Let's go back to our woman who bleeds. As a woman, she was neglected because she was impure and had not got her rights met. She was ostracized just simply because she bled and was unclean. She was reviled as she called impurity to anyone she met, and that actually would have happened to Jesus as well and any of the people she met in the crowd. She would very likely have been infertile and therefore not a fit mother. Really, a woman's status is dictated by whose daughter you are, what children you have, and who you're married to. So that when they see me out in Africa, they think I'm a very sorry state, really, as an orphan with seems to have no siblings, no husband, no family. But I said to them one day when I was in Nigeria, but I have Jesus in my heart, and that shut them up. Certainly since it was in an Islamic country, that they went off on a big old debate about that one. So this woman is highly likely to have been childless as well, and quite possibly abandoned by her husband because of that, and quite possibly divorced, or other wives would have followed her who would have given the husband her sons and daughters. She would also have been socially excluded. So healing was possible because Jesus showed her compassion and caring as more vital to living life than distancing themselves from all that might defile. So he was prepared to stand in and risk being defiled, not being able to go to the synagogue, for the sake of this woman. What was her character like, we wonder, in order to stand up to this? Well, clearly she was brave, just a bit like Deborah this morning. You've got a right day of women heroines today with Deborah and this woman. She was prepared to face God, her leaders, and do a very public act for dealing with her impurity. She was radical as well. She approached Jesus in stealth. And in those times, the tassels on the prayer shawl that he would have worn would have been what there was obviously often an association with magic, so she probably would have been going for those. In my view, she was healthy as well. She sought to live life differently and was willing to risk much to change both her own condition but also the wider attitudes in society. I think that's very similar to mental health today. We're trying to get away from stigmas where people are excluded, stigmas against disability or special needs in churches like this, because it's about meeting people's rights to fulfill a whole life. And she was persevering as well. We know that despite having had an illness for 12 years, she probably would have been tired and anemic. She was determined. Interestingly enough, this 12 years is quite an interesting parallel in this parable, because we know of Jairus, who we come to next, that he was a father of a girl of 12 years old too. He shows himself to be a very different character, powerful, yet he went to Jesus as the powerful miracle worker. He was a synagogue leader and would have had status and prestige, but he was desperate. His only daughter was dying. As a man, he would have had automatic rights to authority just by his gender, and his status would have given him wealth. But he could come to pray for cures and yet not overcome death. He'd gone to all the different medics, and yet nothing could work for his daughter who was dying. And as a loving father and husband, his only child was dying, and he was prepared to humble himself. As we heard in that reading at the beginning, he knelt at the foot of Jesus. So despite his status, what was his character like? I think trust is a power of, he trusted in the power of goodness and healing and the faith that was stronger than all that kills spirit and leads to despair. He was prepared to go out on a limb and in front of people to actually humble himself. He was self-effacing, did not let fear that the power for his daughter would be used up on another woman. And I think it's interesting, he could have got quite paranoid and angry that Jesus' power would have been used up by this irritation, this interruption on the way to his house to cure his daughter. He could have been annoyed that Jesus was being delayed by a woman that was going to defile Jesus, because then Jesus would theoretically have gone for ceremonial washing. But he showed his vulnerability. He fell at the feet of Jesus and pleaded. So let's go back to our woman. What did she do? She was desperate. She suffered after 12 years of chronic, abnormal, embarrassing illness and probably psychological disease. She'd probably endured all sorts of cures and treatments, and certainly many of the treatments I see in Africa do an awful lot worse than the condition the person was going for in the first place. She was hopelessly incurable and getting worse under the care of the different doctors, and she would have been destitute having spent all her money on these cures. Interestingly enough, we're having one of our country profiles come online this week, and we've just done some work for Tear Fund in Tanzania, and out there was a little girl that died quite recently at about 2 years old. She had a skin infection and a white discharge, very much about along the lines of what we learned today, basically a bacterial infection. She was taken off to the witch doctor, had FGM, and died of a hemorrhage. All she needed was antibiotics. She did not need to lose her life. What else did this woman do apart from being desperate? She was earnest. She'd clearly have heard of Jesus, the demoniacs of Gerasenes, Jairus pleading for his daughter from the crowd, healing of the paralytic, the shriveled hand, the diseases and spirits, the centurion's son, the widow's son. Jesus would have been well known in this context. She also believed herself that he could cure. And certainly I think one of the things is that if you believe, miracles happen around you. I had mental health issues myself. I had chronic depression for about 7 years after my parents died. And I think I went on an alpha course, and it never crossed my mind, the people that prayed for me, that my prayer wouldn't be answered, and therefore it was. But I didn't think that was anything unusual. They prayed, I was healed, whatever. Came back next week, but they seemed very surprised. They said I should even keep my tablets and not throw them away. I'd have thrown them in the bin by then, so it's a bit late. But I think if you have hope, if you have faith, things happen. And I think God gave me that miracle so that when I went around Africa, I could also pray for others' healing and miracles would happen. This woman also believed in, broke the social taboos of being unclean, unwelcome, not touching people. She would have known if she touched Jesus, he would be unclean and not able to do so in public. And finally, she had hope in Jesus, not to be intimidated. She was, after all, in a large, crushing, pressing crowd, but she believed Jesus would help, and that actually the most important thing for me in this is she actually acted. And I think that is one thing I've learnt by my faith. It's no good just having hope and trust. You have to act. And she stepped out in faith. So, women with FGM. Well, I think it's easy to judge in the West when people have got a different cultural issue to us, a different taboo. But actually, they are godly women. They just have a different worldview. Their values are a little bit Levitical and quite rule-bound. So we need to show them the love of Jesus to show that our God is different from their way of practicing. They're usually devout, often Muslim, though not exclusively, because certainly in Tanzania there's more Christians than Muslims that practice FGM. And in Ethiopia, all three faiths of Jews, Christians and Muslims practice FGM. So it's easy for us to think it's not our issue, but it absolutely is. That she would have been family-minded, wanting the best for her daughters, because if she didn't cut her daughter would have, in that period, the daughter cannot marry, and therefore she would have a single life. There's a woman I know, I've been dealing with her case study recently, who's an asylum seeker. She's in an asylum. She's going to be deported. But she's 51. She's never married because she's an uncut woman. So she's not allowed to marry because she's seen to be a child. She's scared of going home to her home country in Africa because she knows her mother will still cut her, her mother being 70-odd. These women with FGM are prayerful. They always say, inshallah, if Allah wills it, my daughter will live. But I always say, I don't think Allah's got anything to do with this, and then they get very upset about that. But really, I don't think Allah does want these girls to be cut. It's not a religious practice. It's a myth and legend that just perpetrates misogyny, and I think that's where we need to come in and educate differently. There's a good story recently, a girl in Kenya, a Maasai girl. The cows were dying, so the family changed and didn't move around so much. She went to school, learnt in a health club that FGM gave all sorts of complications, and ran away from her family, educated her community. She's become a teacher, and FGM has ended in that community. And the whole community has become Christian. How much better does it get in a story than that? It is true as well. So these women have hope. They risk the security, and in this case, the love was better than risking security. So finally, what does this woman do? This woman was satisfied. She went to Jesus, who could receive her and knew in her spirit that he had touched her. She had touched him and he had cured her. He sensed her secret. He was willing to heal her, and he could control his power and allow the touch to heal her. He saved her from affliction. She felt she was healed, and she knew instantly the bleeding had stopped. He restored her social standing by making it a public declaration, because otherwise nobody would have known that she was healed and could go everywhere everyone else could go in future. And finally, he cared for her. Her fears were allayed. He called her daughter, an endearing, intimate term of love, and showed compassion. He also saved her from sin by saying that her faith had healed her and granted her redemption. Your faith has made her well. So she got the full-on alpha package all in one incident. So what is the lot of women? Well, often women are barren. They can't have children for some reason. They sometimes perceive it to be a divine punishment, which I don't believe it is. Sometimes they blame it on God, which I don't think is true. Sometimes they're stigmatized. We can stand against that. Sometimes they're victimized by being a second wife and a husband will go on to a younger woman. We can stand against that. And sometimes they can't take part in family celebrations, and it's up to us to actually bring them to the table and to show that that the poorest can actually be at the table as well, and their torment can end. Certainly when I went to the fistula clinic in Nigeria, my boss would never go near the girls. She'd sit in her office and eat every day. I'd go down to sit with the girls and sit on the floor. And they were always sitting on a plastic mat when I got there. And I said, well, why don't they sit on the school benches? And they said, because they smell and they urinate on them. And I said, well, we've got hose pipes. Let's wash them down. So it's just bringing them up, giving them dignity, and for me to sit with them. I've always thought it must be a bit like the prodigal son, actually. I'm sure after the first week, I probably smelt the same as then anyway. So I think the son that lived in the pigsty probably didn't really know how bad he smelt. So it's just a humbling gesture to restore someone's dignity. So what can we learn? We can learn that God and Jesus honours. With faith, even in the small, if we have a small mustard seed size of faith, Jesus honours that and meets us there. Even if we ourselves don't have faith, and some people here tonight might have no faith, I think then other people stand in the bridge and they stand for faith for us until we have it ourselves. We can learn to be approachable in all circumstances and hold out our hand to the vulnerable, the excluded, the people in the minorities of society. We can show compassion of those that don't have yet faith, but we can actually show them and listen to their story and be there for them. And we can understand that sometimes God gives us circumstances to enter our lives that reduce us to desperation, and that's okay. My non-Christian friends think I have a rosy life, that by being a Christian I have no problems. It's like my problems started with being a Christian, actually, I tell them, and they say, well, why would I want to be a Christian then? So I can't win, really. But I actually think with being a Christian you have hope, but I don't think God excludes our challenges, and I think it's a case of the challenges he gives us, we just have to come through them and know that they're for our good. I always hold on to the fact that Jesus, I believe, never gives me a challenge greater than my shoulders can carry. I sometimes think I get a bigger share of my shoulders than other people, but there we are. Maybe I've got broader shoulders, who knows. But I do think I learn from the hard times almost more than the easy times, and I think that's probably my lot in life. So what can we do? We need to restore hope, whether it's women with FGM or fistula or psychological problems, divorce, abandonment, infertility, drug problems, alcohol issues, you name it, it's around in our society, on our streets. We need to be there for hope for those people. We need to bring dignity and sit with people. That's not in judgment, it's to be with them, to put our feet in their shoes and walk with them, a part of the journey for a season. For women with FGM, we need to help them complete their education. We need to help them heal their physical and mental trauma, and we need to provide new skills and employment so they can abandon their old professions of circumcision and have a new life. So, what are the lessons for us to take away from tonight? To understand that the nature of life isn't all that you might have wished for, but actually God gives you back what the ravens might have stolen, and actually the path you're on might be far better than the path you started on. It'll just be different. That lessons come out of struggles, and we get those, and we can share with others, and I think the struggles help us empathize and have compassion with others when they're struggling, even though their struggles may be different. To know that deeper, longer, and sustained joy comes from tough times and coming through. The desert times are followed by the oasis season. And that actually we need to persevere no matter what. I persevered for 7 years before I was finally commissioned into FGM. And at times I thought, you know what, how hard is it? Why can't I just go? But I wasn't ready. And it's with humility I know that now. I just didn't know at the time. But actually, I couldn't have done what I'm doing now without that 7-year apprenticeship. There's a good reason. Apprentices used to be 7 years, I think. And also, it's about personal choice. We have a choice to hope and act. So otherwise, it leaves us like victims, and we don't have to be a victim of our circumstances, however challenging they may be. And that joy is found in a certain place, in a time, in a crisis, in a desert season. But actually, our life is a pointer, an earthly pointer to heavenly joy, which will be in out of all proportion to what we have here. So from today, maybe you've been touched by something. Maybe some of you need to be restored with hope in yourself. Maybe for others, you need to bring dignity to somebody, to help, to heal, to provide, to stand alongside. In terms of what I do, and the calling I feel I've had put on me, I think it's an answer to prayer. I was prepared to honour God with my life and do what he said. I just didn't expect it to be like this. And I'm sure my parents in heaven think, why on earth did she end up doing this? But I think it's that Esther moment. I think I've been called for such a time as this, and this is my job, my perfectly honed calling, just for me, luckily not for you. But you each have one too, and it's a case of finding it or starting along the journey. When Ryan asked me earlier, how do you get from doing an HR career to what you're doing now? I think it's just being obedient, taking one step at a time. It all sounds very logical now, but actually I did a bit of experience, I did a bit of training, I did a bit of course, and somebody once said to me, are you ever going to actually go and do something? And I think I sometimes felt like that as well, but I couldn't have done what I'm doing without all of that behind me. The path behind me looks very logical, the path in front, I have no idea what's coming next. I believe God is with 28 too many. I think he's pleased with what we're doing and we are making an impact, which also pleases me. I think the progress is visible. We are not where we were a year ago. We've now got 20-some volunteers and lots of responsibility, and we are, you know, literally sitting with kings and governments and United Nations, and we are with the movers and shapers standing up for women with FGM in all the societies that spheres of influence that we can make a difference to. There's more to do. The journey's still going on. So if you want to journey with us, there's plenty of ideas. And you can find us. We have our own Facebook page where we post daily. We have a website. We have a blog every week. So if you want to follow us, we have a prayer meeting every month, which is at Margaret Adams House. You can get a quarterly newsletter, which you can follow. Donate, fundraise. I'm doing a couple of sponsored runs, one around London, and then because I was completely mad, I decided to sign up for one that seems to be in a mud bath in September. So more of that nearer the time. But if you want to do something crazy and for sponsorship, we'd love to hear from it. And we also have volunteers as well. Half our board comes from this church. We've got volunteers here in the room tonight. So there's something for everyone to share our journey. And then I'll be around afterwards and in the weeks to come. So if you want to know more, please come and find me.